Hello, grandkids, and welcome to Stunt Granny Audio Presents OPA number 127. This is Kevin DeFrango. Sitting beside me is Ken Phillips. What is going on, good sir?
Hey, it's good to be back recording with you here. The OPA Studios Northeast? Yeah, that's what we're calling it.
Yeah.
It's a different, you know, we're coming up with a different name every time, I think. That's really
you're,
a good...
You're Central East, then.
That's a solid branding strategy, I think.
keep everyone reeled in with where the location is.
Yeah.
Everyone tunes in for that.
Yeah, and it's best when you confuse the listeners by changing the name every week.
Yeah.
I believe that seems solid to me.
Yeah, it seems like a draw to me. I would think so.
So it's been a little while since we recorded. Things have been afoot in OPA land, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, there have been many things afoot. But you know, these things happen, and we will forge on ahead. And so
there, actually, Kevin, there's been a few things afoot in the broader OPA land as well. I've heard that there's been a few... Steelers who are no longer Steelers.
Yes, Ken. I was honestly thinking, I know someone else who does another podcast on another network that is also a big Steelers fan. I was wondering if maybe during the season we invite her on for a little Steelers bitch sesh, as the kids are calling them. Really, she might have been perfect for this one. Hi, Kelly. The Steelers, I shouldn't say we, because we do not own the team.
No,
we
should make that
it.
Clear. We don't want people to think, you know,
and we're not even minority investors in the Steelers, because I do believe there are a number of minority owners.
That's right.
Not as in minority in the skin color sense, but
no, I'm pretty sure
it's
not.
Possible.
Yeah. I don't really think that it's possible. You're right. It is majority owned by the Rooney family, of course. And I think that they actually had to buy out some other minority owners recently. There was like some kind of rule change that the NFL wanted to make sure that there wasn't like too dispersed ownership, so that a team would be able to kind of make decisions without getting bogged down in squabbling or whatever. So I feel like they had to end up buying out some other, either another branch of the family or something like that. So they did kind of...
I did not see that news.
This was a few years back, I was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So apparently the Green Bay Packers were given an exception to the rule. just because the whole city of Green Bay basically owns that team, so...
Yeah, that would be a little tough to resolve that one.
Mm-hmm, yeah. But speaking of resolving things in the NFL, I guess bye-bye to Le'Veon Bell and Antonio Brown, Kevin. Their saga is come to an end.
Yeah, well, and actually the Jesse James saga has come to an end too, Ken.
Oh.
I'm not sure that one is as big of a problem, although I would definitely say that since he went to Penn State, and is originally from the greater Pittsburgh area, that is somewhat noteworthy, but I don't think the offense is exactly going to be missing out not having Jesse James around.
Yeah, I feel like he has been an asset, but they could probably find somebody else that could be a similar value asset, perhaps at the tight end position.
Yeah, I have a hard time. I always thought that he was better than they gave him the level of play that they let him participate in, maybe I should say. But, you know, it's always one of those things that you're not there at the practices, you're not missing. I'm not always paying attention to whether he's missing blocking assignments in certain plays. That is, again, not really my purview.
Mm-hmm.
You might see a blown play here or there from a certain player, but you're not really seeing the consistency of goodness or badness usually.
Yep, he has made some good plays, but I feel like he was never as much of a fan favorite as Heath Miller. Maybe because his name isn't as fun to to yell after a reception.
Although everyone still does yell Heath after any tight end catches the ball now. Like, I mean, we're going.
It's become a title now. It's like somehow passed on.
Yeah, like, he was with the team, I think he was with the team 3 years, and he was still getting Heath chants last year. It's just like, what the fuck, people? Like, come on.
Yes, he's been elected the team Heath to carry on the office of getting Heath yelled at you whenever you make a catch.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, I guess Jesse James, maybe not the big headline here. As much, Kevin. I feel like you're trying to dodge this issue.
Well, I'll tell you what. One guy that in some ways, to me, there's less to worry about him going missing is Le'Veon Bell. I wish he would still be with the team, but he wanted more guaranteed money. And I do think that that's something that, honestly, both him and Antonio Brown, they both left the team, and they both got a lot more guaranteed money elsewhere than they would have with the Steelers. Now, they didn't... Le'Veon Bell, at least from what I've read now, did not get more money total. He got more guaranteed money. Mm. And he missed out on $14.5 million last year, which is also still got to sting a little bit. Honestly, I understand that he could have gotten hurt if he had played the last 8 games of the season.
Yeah.
But, man, if you know you're going to make $14.5 in 8 games, I don't know why you just don't do that. If you're worried about money... I don't know why you don't do that, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I feel like there was like mishandled communication somehow, and I don't know where it came from. And it's just, you know, looking from the outside, but it seems like there was like some kind of emotional something going on there. Like the team, they weren't really communicating in good faith, or you know, he just didn't come to trust the team somehow. And just didn't, you know, or and vice versa, maybe. They didn't seem like they were really urgently trying to make it happen. Anybody?
And I guess it's two different situations to me with the guaranteed money. I can kind of understand not wanting to give a running back guaranteed money. I'm a little confused about not wanting to give Antonio Brown guaranteed money, or just a wide receiver in general guaranteed money, just because I don't think Antonio Brown has missed like any games, basically, except for the playoff game in Denver when Vontaze Burfict tried to remove his head from the rest of his person.
Right.
And I'm going to give him a big old hard pass on missing that game. But he's really kind of only missed a handful of games over a lot of years. And the guy did an excellent job of keeping himself in shape for really a long time. So that one to me was a little more mystifying as far as shucking out some guaranteed money.
Yeah, I can see why they may have... I mean, it just seemed like he was not happy with his role. So it kind of makes sense on that angle. I mean, he's not going to be, at some point, he's not going to be playing his best if he's not really happy there with the team. So
yeah, and I don't think Ben Roethlisberger helped. And I think maybe we've noted this before. Calling out your best wide receiver on your weekly radio show, maybe not the best place to do this.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and come down on the anti side of that move.
In person at practice, I'm cool. Like, no one's really going to hear about it. And when you state these things in public, it's one thing to do it to a rookie. It's another thing to do it to a guy that you've been tossing touchdowns to for like 8 years. or whatever exactly the time period was.
Yeah, I would think that would be make things really awkward in the locker room there. I mean, yes, you're right. They've been teammates for a long time, and it feels like that could be the sort of thing you would handle face-to-face in that situation. But they could be turning the page now, Kevin. We'll see, I guess.
Yeah, everyone talked about the Steelers circus. I would say that the Steelers circus revolved around those two players, mm-hmm. and honestly, not a whole lot of anyone else.
Unless you count Ben Roethlisberger, which I think there's a case to be made.
Honestly, he's other than the outing of Antonio Brown, he's for the most part kept himself out of the headlines recently. He definitely had his problems in his early days.
I mean, there was recently the retirement speculation. I feel like
It's kind of funny how that got shut down really quick after they drafted a second quarterback in 2 years, and now he's talking about a 4-year extension now. Yeah, he definitely did not help himself out in that department in any way, shape, or form. And it was kind of funny. I remember, I think it was a couple of off seasons ago now, that Mike Tomlin talked about having a competition for everyone, and not that anyone's ever going to take Roethlisberger's position so long as he's on the team. But, you know, it might send at least a little bit of a message when you grab two quarterbacks in back-to-back years and honestly keep both of them and cut Landry Jones, who was... Did he marry Roethlisberger's sister?
Oh, wow, really?
I had no idea. Did their sisters just play on Oklahoma together in basketball?
Well...
I'm trying to remember what that... There was some type of relation going on there.
Yeah.
Maybe Jones didn't sign with them, but there was something kind of interesting with that relationship.
Some familial relationship there, huh?
Yeah. So there's as usual, there is plenty of blame to be spread around. I am kind of hoping that things will be a little less crazy with the Steelers, but they also did. I mean, I'm fairly happy they got two not so big signings out of the way, free agent signings. They signed a cornerback from the Kansas City Chiefs, and I'm remembering his first name and not his last name, honestly, because I know it was Steve. And then they also signed Dante Moncrief from the wide receiver from the Jaguars. And honestly, I know him more from playing in Indianapolis. Not to say that he's going to replace Antonio Brown, but you do need to field some wide receivers, and at least getting a guy that has proven himself on a couple of teams in the NFL is at least one good way to do things. And they had kind of some high hopes for that James Washington, who they drafted out of Oklahoma State. And he had some flashes of good play last year. It was not consistent, but hopefully here in the offseason he can improve things. Again, not really going to... And that to me, I guess, to get back to the replacing Le'Veon... you really do need to find some way to replace Antonio Brown. As much as I love Juju Smith-Schuster, I do believe that the coverage coming his way is going to be far different this coming season than it was the past two seasons.
Yeah. It's there's signs of hope, I guess, Kevin. I know that I didn't really see how much they got screwed with the salary cap on Brown and Bell.
Is there Bell stuff still left over? I know that they're eating $21 million of cap space because of Antonio Brown, which is a lot of cap space to eat.
Yeah, I do believe that they were dealing with some cap space for Bell as well. And that'll probably hurt. You know, I can't think that'll help having a kind of dead money. But, you know, they've done well, I think, with a limited budget in the past. We'll see if they can pull it out again here, get some good players in the draft. See what happens.
Well, Ken, hopefully, if they really, if the Roonies really need to find some money, maybe they need to dust off some of their storage shelves. Maybe there's an old unopened Super Mario Brothers video game on the shelves.
I heard those can be quite valuable.
Maybe maybe they own an old Blockbuster that hasn't hasn't been open a few years in Pittsburgh.
And one that hasn't been destroyed by Captain Marvel falling through the roof. That would be good. Yes, Kevin, I think you're referring to a an article of recent note. There was a special copy of the original Nintendo Super Mario Brothers that had been found kind of out of obscurity, it seems like, and went for auction to sell at an impressive $100,000.
And $150.
Oh,
$100,150.
Thank you for correcting me. That was very very good of you.
Well, there are some handling fees, Ken.
We can't forget those.
And for some reason, I don't know why, the seller said that he wanted to sell it for over $100,000. I would be like, I would not just, that's like doing the Price is Right $1 overbid.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, come on, people. Like, I was looking for 105 at least here.
I don't understand. 100, it does seem like a weird amount, but it is over 100,000, so he can technically claim that.
Yeah, it is the first video game to be sold for six figures.
Yeah, it's so this wasn't just a regular copy of the video game. Apparently, it was a test version?
Yeah, it was a test market launch for NES that was in New York City and Los Angeles in late 1985, and I did not check the hyperlink, but it does state that no one actually knows the exact date in 85 that this game was released.
Yeah, it's known to have been released, but apparently we don't have it nailed down. The record keeping of that ancient epoch was not as good as our own, apparently.
Right. And it's kind of interesting that, A, the game did not come in shrink wrap.
Yeah, it sounded like it was just almost like a sandwich bag situation.
Yeah, it came in a small... and it was sealed with a small matte or glossy sticker. And this is another one that it blew my mind a little bit. Is that there's a handy guy that outlines the many different Super Mario Brothers box variants released between 85 and 94. That is crazy that game was released in a different variety for nine consecutive years.
I'm trying to think of what would have been coming out in 94. I guess there was maybe they had a Super Mario All-Stars or something like that I'm thinking of coming out of that time with kind of a collection of different games. So that might have been included on there.
Gotcha.
That could have been 94. There's no way to find out. No way. Those records haven't survived either, unfortunately.
Well, I guess I could go to the handy guide here just to see. excuse me.
That was just rude for our listeners, Kevin.
Oh, well, and it is kind of interesting that it does come right to watagames.com, which I'm trying to think of the game scorekeeping company that we talked about when we were talking about Billy Mitchell.
Oh, Twin Galaxies?
Twin Galaxies. These guys, they're the authenticator, the be-all and end-all of authenticators of video games and their boxes.
Oh, so these are the official, you know, the people who decide what's what when it comes to video game boxes.
Yeah, because evidently someone looked at this this box that was recently sold and did not realize that it was the extra valuable test market variety. They just thought it was one of the later variants of the game, which is only worth, like, I think still, like, there are some of them that they sold for still up to $3,000. If I had a video game sitting around in a box that was worth $3,000, I'd be pretty pumped about that, honestly.
Yeah, that would be pretty sweet. I believe the most expensive video game I had was maybe worth something like $80. That was like, I mean, it was an older game at the time. I think it was actually, so that's Street Fighter III for the Dreamcast. And I think being for the Dreamcast maybe made it, because it was a little more rare. And that was one of the later games that come out for the Dreamcast, and I don't think they made as many of it. Because the Dreamcast, I don't know if you remember, that line failed.
Oh, no. I did not remember that because, I think I've mentioned before that I pretty much tapped out after Sega Genesis.
Yes. This was my last foray. Well, no, I had a Wii as well, but this was one of the last video game systems that I owned. And it was worth a decent amount of money because it was fairly rare, but not $3,000. That's another ballpark.
And it's always one of those interesting things, too, that this game was still sealed.
Yes.
Like, that's the other thing to me. Like, whether it is a toy or anything like that, I'm like, I've always used it or read it, whether, you know, it might be a comic book, because I guess probably comic book-wise, my highest price one might be, like, the original spin-off Wolverine number one. I mean, I guess I'd have to check. There might be some others in my collection, but that's probably the oldest one and probably a more recognized one.
Yeah, it's probably you might be, sometimes you could be surprised at the ones that are actually worth, you know, the money. It's hard to know sometimes.
But I guess that does make sense. They mentioned in the article that most of these, sometimes a grandparent would buy them and pass away before they were able to give them as a gift.
That's how they would survive in this good of a condition.
There are like a number of different scenarios. So I guess it was something that I never really thought about.
I wonder if they're all horribly tragic. I can't think of any. Is there any like happy scenarios where this would happen? No, because at the end of the day, somewhere there's a kid that's not playing this game.
Because the quote unquote happiest scenario would be like, oh, sorry, Blockbuster, you're out of business, and people lost their jobs, you know? Like, it's not someone dying, but it's still not a happy scenario.
Yes, that was the other way from video stores going out of business, that there's been cases where they found old games like this as well. Yeah, I don't know. It's it was compared in the article to a record sale at the time of Action Comics number one, the first issue with Superman to appear, and how that was a very seminal moment in terms of comic book collecting for the price that it was able to get. And this is a similar moment because this was by far, I think, the most expensive video game that was sold as a collector's item. And I don't know. I feel like there's a little bit of a difference there between comic books and video games, because when you're reading when you're playing a video game, there's other, you know, there's, okay, this game, if you put it in your Nintendo system, would play like any other copy of Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, right.
To me, it's like it's only valuable as like this collector's item. But then I guess too, you really probably wouldn't be reading Action Comics number one if you you know, paid six figures for it, or would you? I don't know. It's hard to get into that mindset because I'm not the sort of person who would be dropping that much money on a comic book. But
yeah, I don't understand. Well, I understand now, I guess, how these things get into that type of condition. And normally it's from, you know, non-use, which is kind of bizarre to me. Still in some, like, people that actually had them and kind of barely used them, it's a little bit strange. But I guess those cases are somewhat rare. But yeah, I don't want to drop that kind of change on something like this. And it would be tough to try and read that, but that is so famous. Like, it's something that I guess I haven't read. Like, I guess if someone scanned it in and you could read it in PDF format or something like that, but doesn't it kind of devalue the comic in some ways at that point? Like, if everyone can spread it around the internet, like...
I guess this day and age, you're right. I was going to make the argument that the game was different because there were so many more copies of it that existed out there. And, you know, you can get it to run on emulators on your computer these days. But so it's not as unique is what I was going to argue. But now you're probably right. I'm guessing there are PDF versions available somehow for the, you know, for that Superman comic. So maybe they're both in the same boat, really. If you wanted to really get the content of it, it's available elsewhere. You could argue that the PDF is not quite the same as having the actual comic. But
I agree. And I do. I think it would be tough, honestly. Well, when I was reading this article, I wasn't completely buying what they were selling as far as these things becoming as valuable as comic books. I know that there's going to be more collectors eventually, but I also know that it points to the market just kind of drops off. Because I used to be in the baseball card collecting thing, and now I just have a bunch of cards that are sitting around, and it's kind of hard to offload them.
Yeah, it depends, I guess. I believe I found that, you know, Magic cards seemingly are being collected by people still, and they can be worth money still, which is interesting.
I hope my Norit is worth a lot of money.
Oh, yeah, I got to keep a hold of that one. from Ice Age, I believe.
Yes, Ice Age.
Yeah. But yeah, it's depending on, you know, you really can't predict what the market's going to do. And then you also have to find somebody who's going to be willing to pay that money. So it's a little tough sometimes.
Well, yeah. And even in this case, three people ended up buying this one item. They were still trying to figure out how exactly to split it up.
Oh, right.
Because they were keeping it in someone's vault. I guess I'd have to go back and... read where they were keeping it exactly, but
something like a safe deposit box, maybe, or they would be able to like individually visit it if they wanted to. I mean, that's what I don't know. You visit it, maybe they're doing it as like an investment. I presume,
yeah. They, like I said, like, I guess I have a hard time believing that someone's gonna up the price of it. Heritage Auctions. Is where it's going to be kept when it's not being displayed at conventions and other events.
Well, they did say that this is, from what people can tell, a unique item, that there really isn't another game of this version in this condition, unopened, still sealed.
I believe the article said that there's one other that has been talked about, but no one has provided pictures.
There have been rumors, yes.
Which is still another one that's just kind of crazy to me. Like, oh, I'm just going to make up some wild shit about a game that is pretty much impossible to get a hold of.
Yeah. Well, there's probably very little downside if you, you know, want people to pay attention to you for a little while. That's a nice thing, you know, to say. To get people to be like, oh, interesting. And there's no real downside for you, I don't think. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess in terms of investment, when you're doing something, you know, people do like video games. So maybe it's not the craziest investment, especially it being literally a unique piece of video game history, I suppose. It's not an exaggeration to say. Because I think Super Mario Brothers was actually pretty big in terms of, you know, turning video... At that point, video games had been going through the crash, I think, of 83. And Super Mario Brothers really kind of reinvigorated the whole video game market. So, in a way.
Yeah, and I remember playing that one quite a bit. And that was one thing that the article did bring up is possible candidates. And it's one to me that will live in my heart a little bit closer than Super Mario Brothers itself, even. Even if it was a little bit earlier of a game that I had played, it was Super Mario Brothers 3 is one that I will always hold near and dear. Like, that was one where I kind of understood the concept of games better at that point. You know, Super Mario Brothers, I might have been a little too young in some ways to appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time 3 came around, I was rip roaring for games, and it holds a special spot.
I am firmly on record being in the Super Mario Brothers 3 is a great game camp, and I feel like that's not a very controversial position to be in.
So yeah, because that would be another one that I would imagine. It would probably be easier to find in that, like you said, if Super Mario Brothers helped kind of bring the market out, I would think that there would be more of these available in some ways, but it'd still be tough. Again, like, it's something that you played and you probably wore out, more than likely.
For sure.
Yeah. So how many of these things unopened are there out there? And it's got to be pretty limited.
There's rumors there's one, Kevin. That's all we know.
That is true. More rumor mill about the video games.
Well, if that second copy should ever appear, we will be sure to follow up and let everybody know about it. All of our listeners, anyway.
Oh, and that article that's linked to about all the different variants, it's very long, and it's not just about Super Mario Brothers. Oh. It's about the different things. Because I do remember in that article, too, that there's one version that there's a trademark on the box instead of a copyright, I believe. Oh. Or maybe it's the other way around. So that's kind of one of the variations. Yeah, there's all kinds of...
Some subtle differences there.
Yeah, there are some that are just very subtle differences.
Well, sometimes, Kevin, people can be a little unsubtle when they are trying to fulfill some basic human needs.
I might have to chalk that one up on this segue 2019... great segue list. I know it's still pretty early in the year, but
yeah, it's never too early to recognize greatness, I think, and I appreciate that.
We you know, around here we don't want to engage in recency bias, and I think that one needs to be on the list.
Yeah, because in my book at least, grabbing a tray of tacos and hiding them in your desk is really not subtle.
This article is about free food at the office.
Mm.
I will admit that I'm in a much different situation than many of these people that that are in the article, because I do not work in a large office.
Right.
If anything comes in, there is not a stampede. It is a stampede of a total of 7 people, possibly, which again is not a whole lot of people,
right? it's hard to make a stampede with seven cows, for instance.
Yeah.
Although you still wouldn't want to be trampled by seven cows, I would think.
No, that would still be very uncomfortable.
And you would have to sort of, I don't know. I would be panicked if they were running towards me. I feel like I might be able to get out of the way still if they weren't going to chase me, you know? But yeah, so not quite as bad as a stampede. Still not great, is what I'm saying. But I do think that there's something about having less people in the office when there's free food being kind of less triggering of there being a shortage. You know what I mean? Like a shortage mentality that could lead people into some of these behaviors.
Yeah. And my wife works at a much larger facility.
Mm.
And I just kind of laughed at this because I feel like these are some of her stories that she has brought back to me about large numbers of people overeating, not allowing other people to take some free food. As you noted, there was someone that took tacos and put them in their desk for later.
Yeah.
Which, I guess I wouldn't want my desk to smell like tacos. No. Like, it would linger.
No one would. I don't understand that. Like, there's some sort of, you know, I don't know. That person needs help, is what I'm saying. There's something not right there.
And I guess there is something interesting because, and maybe this is more of a, I'm going back to college mentality, just because I remember maybe not a stampede, but you and I, when I'd stop into State College, going out for $1 pitchers at a certain bar.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm trying to think, there was a place at Kent that sold, I say, maybe it was a $5 large pizza. Mm. And I mean, obviously part of it was the time, literally. But it was still a steal to get a large pizza. And the fact that I could consume one on my own is still something that is kind of bizarre. And not something that I can even remotely do now.
Different times, I guess.
But I guess I do at least a little bit understand the mentality that you always kind of, if something's free, you always want it. And for some reason, it kind of overrides your senses for if it's free or extremely cheap, maybe I should say. It kind of overrides your senses. Because I would have to say that $5 pizza was probably not the best pizza.
I'm guessing not. But you're right, and I do think that the other thing is this kind of perception of there being a scarcity that can lead people to, and it actually creates a scarcity because when there's people who are getting in there to be like, oh, I need to get this before somebody else does, then, you know, they're taking extra and actually leaving less for everybody. There's not enough to go around now suddenly. And that's part of some of the stories in this article where people who, if they weren't there within like 10 minutes, like everything would be gone basically.
Yeah. And the wife has basically said that there was pretty much a 30-minute window when some stuff would open. If you weren't there within the first 30 minutes, you were just out. So at some point she just stopped going.
Yeah.
Because she knew, you know, she knew it wasn't worth it. And that's one that, to me, timing-wise, is always kind of interesting. Because I always felt like, well, since she works at a hospital, shifts tend to be, to me, a little bit on the early side as opposed to some working people. So eating at 11:30 maybe isn't quite as odd when you're getting there at 7 a.m.
Hmm.
You know, I guess I always base things off of a probably an 8 a.m. start time. Right. So I'm always thinking noon or later for lunch.
Yeah. Yeah, I think if you get there a little earlier, some people do try to take a little earlier lunch as well.
Yeah, so I at least that part of the equation I can understand. But, yeah, these people just really loading up on stuff is pretty crazy. You know, I actually have the opposite problem where people at my office don't want to finish it. Hmm. It's just like everyone's okay with going and getting the first round, but then when there's the last one there, no one wants to look like a, I'm just going to say pig, and finish it off. So I'm always just like, oh, you know, after a few years, it's just like, oh, screw it. Like, this is going to sit around here for like 3 days because there's only one of them left.
Mm-hmm.
And I just go ahead and eat it.
Doesn't make sense. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, let's just leave this one Girl Scout cookie at the bottom of the box. Oh, come on, man. Don't leave just one. Just eat the thing. Come on.
It will be interesting to see if, you know, moving to a bigger company, if you experience any of that stuff as well. But, or a different company at least. But hopefully
yeah,
not.
Yeah, it's definitely bigger. But still, I'm not sure, because this article is talking about having to send out memoranda in certain companies to say not to take too much, and then altogether having to shut down the free food because people, even after several emails, were not obliging and allowing other people to get food.
Or like people showing up with Tupperware to take, you know, home with them.
Oh. I forgot about that one.
And then they said there's people who would show up on the weekends and, like, bring coolers and, like, raid the kitchen snacks.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. That was the one that they just kind of, oh, yeah, they kept stuff. There were people that worked on-site and off-site, and the people that worked off-site would come in and raid the coolers.
Oh, that's right, yeah. It's pretty messed up. Maybe the worst one was, or certainly the least subtle, Kevin, was the people who would be like hanging around, and they were literally called vultures. They would, you know, there's like a glass wall for the meeting room, and they would be like visibly circling out in front of the door, waiting for the meeting to be over so they could get the extra food that was left over. It's like, seriously? You have another job, don't you? I mean,
well, you have a job at that office to yeah. do, right?
You're not actually being paid for that. You're right. I'm sure they're not being paid to circle the meeting food. but I feel like it's so embarrassed. Like, I cannot imagine thinking that would be okay, and like how embarrassed I would be to think like the people in there are like looking at me, acting like a freaking. You know, raccoon trying to raid the trash cans.
I am a human trash panda.
Yeah. And just in front of clients too. That's just as wild to me. Like that people would think that would be acceptable. And eventually I think they came up with a sensible solution of saying that people can't grab the food right out of the meeting room. They had to wait for the office manager to put it into the cafeteria like human beings.
Oh man, yeah. I mean, it's still crazy to me that that companies had to resort to that.
It reminds me of when I feel like this has been going on for a while, because when I first started in my office job, I was working at a temporary agency for the city of Dublin. When I first moved out here, I can remember being shown around, and the guy who was taking me around, like I can still remember the amount of joy that he radiated when he would talk about how sometimes they put free food out. And like, I can remember him, you know, always being there whenever there's free food, and just, you know, at the time thinking, well, this is cool. You get free food. You know, it's a nice thing that they do.
Uh-huh.
But looking back to think about like how much priority he gave to there being free food, I think he would basically drop everything whatever he was doing, and you know, immediately go get whatever snack or treat that they had put out. So this is a phenomenon with a long history, I would say.
Yeah, to me, it's even kind of, at least to me, a little reminiscent of going to a large family, you know, like a family reunion or something of that nature, where I never, when they go, time to eat, I'm like, okay. And, like, I know that there's going to be a stampede to the food.
Right.
And it's just like, no, not dealing with that. Or even, like, at a wedding, if they don't release people or release tables in a certain order, it's just like, I'm going to take a pass. I'm going to give this about 15 minutes and then I'll go up there. Like, I'm not that concerned.
Yeah, I guess the other thing with being in a crowd is that people kind of lose their inhibitions and they feel a little bit less responsible because they're, you know, there's like a diminished sense of responsibility among all the members of the crowd. You feel like you're a little more anonymous because no one can really keep an eye on you, just you, since there's so many people around, that people are going to want to be acting a little more selfish, perhaps, in ways that they would not if, say, you're in an office of only seven, and people are going to see if you're a pig. there's no crowd to kind of disappear into.
You know, and I guess I did forget the less than subtle hashtag that I used a number of years ago, idiot intern. You know what? Even in a group of seven, there are some people that just don't have any shame. Like, I think he would be in the vulture category that puts it in this one.
Wow.
Like, he did not have any problem eating a lot of whatever got put out there. You know, he that was the one time that there was not a problem with someone finishing stuff off. And during that, like, two or so year time period that he was in the office,
he would take that mantle gladly.
Yes, he would.
Speaking of taking mantles, we're having there's a new show that will be taking up the mantle of the Lord of the Rings, Kevin, yeah. Coming to Amazon.com video.
Yeah, and I'm pretty pumped about this because I feel like the last time we talked about this,
there's a lot of question marks.
Yeah, there's still a lot of question marks. There's still a lot of question marks.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that there are a few less question marks.
Yeah.
Just because I do believe now it's going to be out in 2020, which I don't feel like we had a year previously.
Right. This is coming. I believe when we originally talked about this, it was very early stages. They had just announced that they were even going to be doing a series. And as you say, we do have a little bit more information coming out now. There had been a couple of articles I read about the levels of security, speaking of information getting out, that were being taken on this for the writer's room for this show. Apparently, they have fingerprint scanners to get into the room. There's also a security guard. They have taped all the windows and covered them so that nobody can look in and see, the whiteboard or what they're working on in there.
So this is kind of like the Masked Singer, except different, except Lord of the Rings.
The Masked Ring Lord, I guess. Yeah, you could say that, Kevin. That's a beautiful analogy. Yes.
Well, I try to get into the other pop culture, right, that isn't completely nerdy from time to time.
Yeah, you're right. We should try to ride on those coattails a little bit. The Masked Singer was a big hit. So if we can get a little bit of that halo on us, I think that's not a bad thing.
Get a little bit of that Ken Jeong's shine.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, the news that we saw that we're referring to is a map that they tweeted out showing the Isle of Numenor, which, for people who are not big Lord of the Rings nerds, and you could have seen all the movies, and I would dare say read all the books, and still not necessarily be clear on this point. This is what you might call a bit of a deep pull, which is...
Yeah, I've got to admit, this was one where I started reading this, and I'm like, I know I've read all the books, but I'm like, I really need to, you'd at least need to reread The Silmarillion, to me, since you're talking about a deep pool. Like, This is probably the least popular of the main books that came out from J.R.R. Tolkien.
Well, it's interesting, Kevin, because I am very sure that the Tolkien estate has not authorized the Silmarillion to be portrayed as a film or TV series or anything like that. The movie for The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit was sold off while J.R.R. Tolkien was still alive, I believe.
Correct.
But yes, as we've, I think, that also discussed in the show, they are not willing to, it seems, release rights for the Silmarillion. But the outline of this sort of story was actually in the appendix for The Lord of the Rings. So I believe that is how they are going to be able to portray some of this story here.
Yeah, there's a lot of appendix in the original Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, they had several appendixes, everything you could want to know about lots of things, but still, strangely, not everything. But yeah, you get the months, the different calendar systems that are in use throughout the different peoples of Middle Earth. You know, obviously a bunch of stuff about Elvish, and some other stuff about kind of history. And this was what they're going to be pulling from here for this this series. So as I said, the Isle of Numenor, it was basically an analogous to Atlantis, like the myth of Atlantis. It is a island that was populated by an advanced civilization. And these would have been the, you know, basically Aragorn's great-great-great-great-grandparents. They kind of became the, in later years, the line of kings of Middle-earth came from these people. But from what I can tell, this is going to be taking place during the time period when they were still ascendant, before the downfall of Numenor, where they suffered basically the same fate as Atlantis and sunk to the ocean bottom.
Yeah, and that's pretty exciting.
So this is like a totally different time period.
We
wouldn't expect to see any of the characters from The Lord of the Rings that we know, except possibly, well, I guess Elrond, Galadriel, maybe... Gandalf, perhaps, depending on what time we're talking here. Although I'm not sure about that one. I'm not sure if Gandalf came over to Middle Earth in the Third Age or the Second Age. So
yeah, that would certainly. Well, and that's another one is that I'm not sure if we set out loud that this is the Second Age, just prior to the Third Age. Like it's kind of shuffling into that time frame. It's still incredible to me the amount of effort and detail that he put into this whole thing. It's pretty amazing to me, to be honest with you. But I guess when you have time and you're being shot at in the trenches during World War One, maybe you're trying to do anything to keep your mind off of not getting your head blown off.
Yeah, I'm really excited about. There's that. Tolkien movie that's going to be coming out here at some point, the biopic about J.R.R. Tolkien.
I was not aware of that one.
Yeah, I'm not sure when that's coming out, but I feel like we're coming up close to when it should be.
Okay.
So that's another thing to keep an eye out for, Kevin. Not just this TV show, which I am looking forward to.
We do have an Amazon Prime account, so it is something that. I do not use it too much.
We recently,
but I definitely will use it when this comes around.
We recently canceled our Prime membership because we felt like we weren't using it a whole lot. But come 2020, I may be sorely tempted to rejoin Prime again here, which I suppose will leave Jeff Bezos cackling on his throne of. $100 bills.
Oh well.
You know, that's, I guess, why they paid $1 billion for this. Was it a billion? I remember it was close to... It was something ridiculous that they paid for this. It should be a well-produced or at least an expensively produced TV show to watch. So
yeah, well, he might not be sitting on the hundreds. I think he might be sitting on the Salmon P. Chase's the $100,000 bill that is no longer in circulation. Yeah.
That would probably be more like what we the kind of scale that we're talking about, I'm sure. Yeah. he could source those somehow.
Yeah, why not? Well, speaking of sources, Ken.
Oh my God, are we going to have time to get into this one?
Well, we don't need to. We can just wrap it up. Wrap it up? Yeah, we can wrap it up by talking. We can talk some Belltime beer because I forgot to mention last week was my birth of days.
Mm.
And the wife was kind enough to get a variety of, I would definitely call them a more subtle beers. One of them was just a plain lager, which was called a garage beer from Braxton Brewing that I had when I was recording Stunt Granny audio number 498 earlier this week. Tonight, because we're headed towards the old Irish holiday of St. Patrick's Day, we went with the North High Brewing Road, which is their Irish Red Ale. 4.7% ABV, no IBU listed. But it is fairly tasty. Again, it's not like there's just not a lot of hops in an Irish red ale, and that's fine by me. You know, I think I've advocated the non-hoppy beers previously quite a bit. It does have maybe to me a little more of a more subtle redness to it than some other Irish reds that I've had. But it's still quite enjoyable and easy to drink, which is why I brought out a second beer during this very show, Ken.
Yeah, and I don't know if that throw to me is to introduce our second beer, but it's a brew from the Magic Hat Brewing Company, Barroom Hero Pub Ale, and Dropkick Murphys. Wait, isn't that a band?
Yeah, they brewed this in conjunction. This seems to be the new thing, is to brew beers in conjunction with bands, because Stone Brewing has done one with Rancid and with, I'm trying to think of, I feel like there's a second band that they've done a beer with, and they've also done one with Will Wheaton.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Now, he's, as far as I know, not a rock band.
No, you kind of do, you use someone in pop culture, maybe.
Sure.
I was trying to rattle off the bands, but I was also thinking of, because I think they're going to be in their fourth or fifth year of doing the Woot Stout with Will Wheaton, Stone Brewing.
I was just thinking that, you know, sometimes bands have funny names, so there could be a band called Will Wheaton out there that I'm just not aware of. But
this is the person that was on whatever version of Star Trek
The Next Generation.
Okay.
Yes, that's the one.
You are much better at that one than I will hand off those Star Trek duties to you.
That's a fair thing.
Every occasion.
Yeah, I'm not up to date on all of the Star Trek lore, but I am familiar with the Next Generation. That was definitely in my my wheelhouse at the time. But yeah, this was speaking of wheelhouses, I would say that this beer falls into mine as well. I don't know if I've really been a fan of the Dropkick Murphys, but I am a fan of their beer. So I recommend it, and apparently it does somehow benefit a charitable foundation, which I think is part of the marketing on this beer as well.
Yeah, the Clodagh Fund, which is obviously, again, Irish, because they do kind of play an Irish punk style of music. They're out of Boston.
Yep.
And again, it's another light drinking beer. This one definitely is, it's not extremely hoppy, I do think that the hops comes through a little bit more than in the road from North High Brewing. And these guys, Magic Hat is out of Vermont, so it's kind of in the neighborhood there of Boston, which is where the Dropkick Murphys are from.
It's in the New England region, yes.
Yeah, it's in the New England region. And yeah, this one, honestly, out of the three that she got, this Barroom Hero is probably my favorite. Like, there are a lot of, I still don't get the not having, if there's going to be no hops, I want kind of some more maltiness to it. Or if there's a low amount of hops, I want a little more maltiness to it. But this one's like, just has enough hops not to really hit you over the head at all, mm-hmm. but to still be there and to have a play in the taste. But still, it's more of a kind of a light lager type of feel to it.
I agree. I have developed a taste for the hoppiness of beers as I've become more of a beer drinker, I guess. And kind of enjoyed craft beers more than, say, Natty Lights of my college days. So I do appreciate the hoppiness of this beer. And as you say, it still is like refreshing without necessarily choking you with hops. So it's a good choice, I say.
Okie doke, grandkids. He's at Gozer33. I'm at Defrango11. The brand is at Stunt Granny. Rate and review us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or wherever you happen to listen to us. And have a good night.
See ya.